Welcome to the Dollars and Cents Radio Show with your host, accountant and author Carol Topp, the homeschool CPA. Join Carol as she shares her knowledge on a topic of interest to everyone, money. On the show, Carol will discuss starting and running a microbusiness, teaching your kids about money, and managing money in a homeschool organization. Carol takes confusing topics such as money and business and puts them into clear English. She's ready to share her knowledge with you on today's show.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Carol Topp, and welcome to this episode of the Dollars and Cents Show. What I have for you this week will be probably a two-part series called Who's Afraid of the IRS? How the IRS Sees Homeschool Organizations. This was a presentation I presented at the Homeschool Legal Defense Association Leaders Conference in September of 2014. Doing the introduction is Darren Jones. He is an HSLDA staff attorney. I hope you will find this workshop, who I am mostly speaking to leaders of state organizations, very helpful, and I hope it helps you understand how the IRS sees homeschool organizations, and in particular sees your organization. Although you're not a state organization, you're probably a homeschool support group or co-op leader. This will answer a lot of the questions you have about your involvement with the IRS and seeking tax-exempt status. And as always, if you have any questions, make sure you drop by homeschoolcpa.com to read the blog posts and some information I have there. There is a handout that goes along with this audio that I think you will find very helpful. You can find it over at dollarsandcentsshow.com. Just look for episode number 41 called Who's Afraid of the IRS? Or How the IRS Sees Homeschool Organizations, and I think you'll find the handout very helpful. Since some of this information can be a little confusing, please share the handout with your board, maybe even listen to this podcast as a board and discuss the kinds of things I'm talking about, all to help you better run your homeschool organization and also understand your obligations with the IRS to receive the benefits of tax-exempt status. I hope it's helpful.
Carol is a retired homeschool mom, accountant, speaker, author of The IRS and Your Homeschool Organization and Homeschool Co-ops, How to Start Them, Run Them, and Not Burn Out, which I believe she will show you during the course of the time. Carol runs an accounting practice specializing in helping nonprofit organizations, especially homeschool groups. HomeschoolCPA.com, put it on your favorites menu. All right, it's a great resource.
Thank you.
She also hosts a public TV show, Starting a Micro Business, a podcast, Dollars and Cents, on the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. Her website, Homeschool CPA, was named a top accounting blog in 2012. Deserves it every year. Her greatest compliment, she says, came from an audience member who, after listening for 90 minutes, said, "You kept my attention the entire time." That is also my experience talking with Carol, except for the times when she freaks me out and I panic because of things I've been doing wrong. So, listen up. Yeah. Carol and her husband live in Cincinnati, Ohio, so she didn't have to travel very far. No. And they have two daughters, both homeschool graduates. So, Carol,
thank you, Darren. All you. Thank you. Yeah, that's quite a compliment for a CPA. 90 minutes, you kept my attention, so we'll see how I do here. I created a handout that you've all been given, so you don't have to take notes, and some of this stuff can be quite confusing, so I think the handout will help you organize the thoughts afterwards. We can just, you know, have you concentrate on the slides, what I'm saying. We can make this very interactive and ask questions. Now, have you seen this? I love this sign. "Dear IRS, I would like to cancel my subscription. Please remove my name from your mailing list. Don't we wish?" And I think that a lot of homeschool organizations have lived like this for a long time. And they don't know that, unfortunately, there is some reporting requirements. So over at my booth, I did create an article called "Do You Know About the IRS Reporting Requirements for Homeschool Organizations?" It's not actually just homeschoolers. Anybody who takes money, calls themselves a nonprofit, has some IRS-required reporting requirements. It's an article that you can share on your websites or in your magazines or whatever vehicle you want to share that information down to the homeschool organizations in your states. It's also available as a Word document. It's on on the article, so you can easily grab it and electronically share it. So please do that, because I'm here to try to help groups run their groups well, stay out of the IRS's hair, and get back to what they're doing, they want to be doing, which is homeschooling kids, right, and helping homeschool parents. So I want to give you a little bit of the history of the tax exemption so you understand, you know, why are homeschool groups even having to be involved with the IRS? Now you're homeschool parents, so who is this?
George.
King George III. So obviously the first date having to do with tax exemption is 1776, our freedom from England. And there was a huge reluctance on the part of our founding fathers to adopt things that look like the monarchy. So they were very much in favor of charities and of the church and of people of faith organizing and providing services like orphanages and hospitals and education that the monarchy used to. So it was a very different shift from the monarchy to our founding fathers. And that trickles down today. We see evidence of that in the separation of church and state and all that kind of stuff. 1993, what's significant about that date? 1913. Income tax. That's right. The United States instituted an income tax. Before that, you know, it was tariffs and other kinds of taxation. That was the date of the income tax. And what gets complicated then is that basically the government has to look at these corporations or these organizations that were doing charitable work. Let's take a hospital or an orphanage or a school and say, gosh, you are doing things that the government would normally have to do. We're going to give you tax-free status, and we're not going to tax you. So it was really also the establishment of tax-exempt organizations in our country. Not that long ago, if you think about it. Okay, 1927, very close to that for that other date. This was when donations to charitable organizations were tax deductible on the income tax return. Very important for 501c3 charities. So just a little bit of history of where we're coming from. And if you think about it, those are all pretty recent. The whole idea of this tax-exempt status in the United States. And, of course, not every country has tax-free status for charity or educational organizations like our homeschool groups are. Something I think it's a privilege. We need to keep it. We need to exercise it. So earlier this week, I was on the telephone with a homeschool group. They gathered their board and put me on speakerphone. And we're talking about whether they want to become a tax-exempt organization with the IRS. And everybody's on board except one gentleman. And I'm trying to convince him that this is actually a good thing. And it's a privilege to get tax-free status. We should take advantage of it when we're eligible. But basically, he doesn't want to have anything to do with the government or anything to do with the IRS. And I'm trying. I'm trying to give him my little spiel I just gave you guys. I actually at one point said, okay, I'm done preaching, you know, because I'm trying. But I don't think I convinced him. But I think he ultimately said, well, okay, for the sake of the board, everybody else on the board is okay with it. So, but I understand the reluctance of many board members to want to get involved in something they don't want to get involved with. So I understand that. We can talk about that if you want to a little bit more. But mostly I try to get them to see tax-exempt, tax-free status as a privilege. Let's use it. Let's take advantage of it. If we don't, it might go away. And every once in a while it gets threatened. So, yes, sir.
At this point, one of the members of the audience asks a question that's a little bit difficult to hear, but he asks, what are the alternatives to someone who doesn't want to have 501c3 or other tax-exempt status for their organization?
And, of course, he is talking as a board member of a nonprofit, okay, not his personal life. Right. So, you know, that's kind of what I jokingly say. You don't want to be a tax-exempt organization. Oh, so you enjoy paying taxes? Do you think that's less involvement of the IRS in your life? And then they go, oh. I mean, I think they want it back to the old days when you could kind of bury your head in the sand and you could go to the bank and open up a checking account and they didn't make you go get an employer identification number, which is your first contact with the IRS, and now you're on the IRS's radar. That's what they want, and I would like that too. But unfortunately, he kind of said, oh, I guess we have to do that. It's kind of in the end. It's like, I don't like it, but I guess this is the best of the alternatives.
The audience member asks another question, if I would ever encourage a homeschool organization to not seek tax-exempt status. And here's my reply.
Yes, probably not a homeschool organization, but another CPA shared with me that there was one organization that was truly a nonprofit. They were a women's shelter. And they did not go to the IRS and seek tax exemption because the application document and the annual filings are public documents, meaning all their board members and the addresses are listed. And being a women's shelter, they didn't want that public. They have to protect their board members and the women that they protect. So this group, although they're a nonprofit serving women in crisis situations, pay taxes on any surplus that they have. So that's about the only time. If there's some legitimate reason, you have to protect the privacy of your board.
You make it to this later, and if so, feel free to put it off.
I was just looking at my slides here, yeah.
About what size of group do you start looking at tax exemption? Like, I'm meeting together on a, you know, on an informal basis with four other families, and we get together once a month. I assume no. We're meeting every week with 100 families. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. So where's the in-between?
Right. And it comes up later.
It used to be the dollar threshold of $5,000.
Yes.
But now pretty much it's as soon as you're big enough that you need a checking account.
Right.
And that could be anywhere. So I have one group I consulted with, and we ended up concluding, even though you're 10 families, which kind of gets to the size where they might want a checking account, they were going to continue operating in cash in an envelope. Because that was simple enough for them. So I try to give them ways that they can operate as simply as possible. And sometimes just staying out of the banking system is one way to do it.
Is that potentially, though, dangerous? We now live in a society where people are dealing with cash.
Exactly.
For instance, yeah. You're either a drug dealer or a terrorist or both.
Yeah. And this was a tiny organization. They operated with very little expenses. I mean, maybe they brought in a couple $100s over the course of a year. Yeah, and we CPAs don't like you dealing in cash because it's too easy to embezzle and lie, cheat, and steal with it. So you're right. So, yeah, I don't like it either. How the IRS sees homeschool organizations. There's no documentation with the IRS. This is just my experience from reading IRS documents, dealing with nonprofits, understanding the homeschool world. But let's start with homeschool support groups, been around forever. I dealt with one who formed sometime in 1994 this week, right? So they've been around forever. If they called the IRS, described what they did, and got an IRS employee who understood what they did, they would fall under this category called 501c7. Now, the IRS 501c is part of the IRS code. It's the part of the IRS code that exempts organizations from taxes, and there are about 20 of them. Everything from veterans organizations, charities, churches, down to cemeteries. 20 of them. The most popular, 501c3. We'll talk about that in a minute. 80% of 501c organizations are c3s. Very, very hard to get that status, but it's also the most popular. We'll talk about why. 501c7, the IRS calls a social club. These are a bunch of people that get together for social and recreational reasons. Their purpose is to meet for pleasure, like you kind of talked about. This is the good old-fashioned support group, right? We meet together for pleasure, some social interaction, maybe recreation. They have personal contacts. They have fellowship, limited membership, maybe not necessarily limited numbers, but limited in scope. All our members are something, homeschooling in our case, all right? But supported by membership fees, not donations, not co-op tuition. Supported by membership fees. Fits. So far we're tracking with the whole concept of support groups, right? No selling of products or services except to members. Fine. The best example, let me skip down to the bottom, are hobby clubs like gun or hunting clubs, if you belong to those, garden clubs, country clubs, and fraternities, sororities, stuff like that. And you know, the Most of the problems the IRS has with 501c7s is country clubs. Country clubs, okay? So you'll read a lot of stuff about facilities. Anything homeschool support groups don't have facilities. They're talking about country clubs. But anyway, here's some other things. There are no tax-deductible donations to social clubs, which only seems right. You know, they're gathering for social purposes. You shouldn't get a tax deduction if you make a donation to them. Fine, I'm okay with that. This second point is really important. You can self-declare your tax-exempt status, meaning you don't have to fill out the IRS paperwork, apply, and pay their fee, which is $400. So this is how support groups could just start, just be happy, just run, never file anything with the IRS. It went that way very nicely for a long time, till 2010. We'll talk about that in a minute. So that's awfully nice. Just declare yourself tax-free. Wouldn't we love all to do that? There are no limits on legislative activity as well. So homeschool support groups can go out there and talk all they want about legislation, even endorse legislation, all they want. Yes, sir?
So what is the advantage of a 501c7?
Well, it's tax-free, tax-exempt. So their money...
They don't pay tax.
Right, they don't pay taxes on any surplus that they have.
Okay.
It's just a tax-exempt status. Yeah. And it's just what fits most support groups. This happens all over the country, so I've got tons of examples, but here's just a few. You get these 501c7s. Support groups don't call themselves that. They don't know that they're this status. They just think of themselves as support groups, right? They self-declare their tax-exempt status. Many times this happens to me. They've been going for 10 years, 20 years. 1994 this group formed. They think. Who knows? The current board isn't really sure. And all of a sudden, they never did anything with the IRS. And all of a sudden, they stumble across something that says, whoops, you were supposed to, starting in 2010. And that's when they call me, and we'll talk about that in a minute, okay? And I can talk them through about, well, what do we do from here? There's some options. Some groups can close down the old one, start a new one fresh, probably because in some ways they were not organized well to begin with, start fresh. Some of them go back and say, well, I'll start now with the IRS, but there might be something I've missed in the past since 2010. Got to get right with them. We're going to talk about reinstating tax-exempt status that might have been lost. This is more popular, 501c3s. Not really more popular in terms of numbers, but definitely cropping up, homeschool co-ops. This is a picture of my co-op from a couple years ago. They have an educational purpose, and many of them also have a religious purpose. So 501c3s have a set limit. It's of what their purposes can be. It's very clearly stated in the IRS code. Religious, which includes churches. Charitable, religious, educational, scientific, literary, prevention of cruelty to animals, and international sports. I think I got them all. That's it. You got to fit in one. So homeschool co-ops fit in educational. And like I said, many of them are religious too. And the big advantage there is the third point, tax-deductible donations. Now, a lot of co-ops never get a donation. They don't expect to get donations. But they want the tax-free status, so they'll file for 501c3 status because they don't want their surplus taxed. Okay? They're also serving a charitable class, children in this case. So that makes their 501c3 status very certain when they apply, if that makes sense. You can have insubstantial lobbying. Insubstantial, that's not your point. You're supposed to be educating the kids, not using your 501c3 status as a front for lobbying, but you can do some. No endorsing of a candidate is allowed because of the deductibility of the donations. So, see, this is, I understand that. When you understand how people could misuse this status, you kind of understand why there's that limit. I don't want some candidate setting up a 501c3, getting a bunch of tax-deductible donations from his supporters, right, when the real purpose was supposed to be charitable, educational, religious, etc. Yes, sir?
Insubstantial?
They define it. They define, the IRS defines it. And I think they actually put a percentage. I think it's, do you remember, Darren, is it 2% of your income or expenses, or is it higher than that, 20, 5?
Well, see, 5 is okay, and 20 is too much.
Okay.
But they haven't done anything.
And that's percent of expenses.
Percent of expenses,
yeah.
Percent of time that people are doing. That's a big one, is, you know, if you're starting to send out a whole bunch of emails on it, they may look at percentage of emails and how much time someone's spending.
And usually the IRS doesn't look unless somebody complains about you. And they go to audit, and they don't audit small nonprofits very much. They don't have staff to do that. We know that. The IRS is kind of nice for us in the nonprofit world. They usually have a statement at the beginning of the year saying, these are the kind of nonprofits we're going to audit this year. You know, so they were focusing on hospitals for a while. Then they were focusing on colleges that had stadiums with corporate signs, you know, and colleges that had unrelated businesses making it. So anyway, it's kind of nice. So far, homeschools have not made the list of what the IRS is auditing in the nonprofit world. But, you know, the obvious examples are churches, Red Cross being a charitable organization, private schools, and homeschool co-ops because of that educational purpose. Yes?
Are there any taxes that this 501c3 does?
Yes, they do. Thank good question. Do you know the answer? Are you just feeding me a question? Are you really asking? employment taxes. When they pay an employee, the employer, the nonprofit co-op, still has to pay Social Security and Medicare to the state, unemployment, and workers' comp on employees. Most homeschool co-ops do not have employees. If they hire anybody, they hire outside people to come in as teachers, usually pay them as independent contractors. So most of them do not have any taxes that they pay. They can sometimes get income tax status from their state, and sometimes, depending upon the state, sales tax exemption as well, which is really nice if they're buying curriculum and things like that. Yes, ma'am? You guys are asking great questions. Thank you.
I'm involved in a tutorial, which is like a co-op.
Yes.
We do hire the instructors. And so there is, and we, you know, there's a tuition, per se, charge.
Yep.
That could still fall under 501c3?
Yes, because you have an educational purpose and you're serving a charitable class, which is children. Yes. Now, those tutors or teachers, you're treating them as employees?
No, independent contractors.
Okay, and that the IRS would prefer you treat them as employees, but I wrote a whole book called Paying Workers in a Homeschool Organization where we talk about how you tell the difference.
Okay.
So it has a matter of control, how much you control them, which is beyond the scope of this.
Could be involved in taxable other business.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. There is something the IRS calls unrelated business. So if your 501c3 conducts an unrelated business, you might have to pay tax on the profits of that business. And the classic example is the gift store in a hospital. The gift store has very little to do with the purpose of the hospital, which is providing medical care. So the hospital administrators will carve out the revenue and the expenses of that gift shop and say, we got to file a tax return on that part. Not to get off track, but most homeschool co-ops might do fundraisers. Fundraisers are considered an unrelated business. They have nothing to do with the education of the children, right? You know, turning in box tops doesn't have to do with education of children, right? It has to do with eating cereal and getting cash back. But there are a few times, there are several exemptions that the IRS says, like, okay, I won't consider that taxable income. And the biggie is if the program is run completely by volunteers. So that's a big, because most homeschool co-ops run their fundraisers by volunteers. They have no paid staff. Or you bring in less than $1,000 a year. Most homeschool co-ops are not doing that much fundraising. So those things help them avoid being taxed on this side business called fundraising. So here's just a example of something that happened, a support group, and this is happening a lot. As homeschooling grows, these support groups are growing, and all of a sudden they start adding things like co-op classes. And very typical, there was a group in Florida. So they were a 501c7, and they called me and they started telling me about their activities, and I realized, you're really eligible for 501c3. Do we want to talk about going down that path instead? Because you're really moved from being just supportive mom and dad, but mostly moms, you know, to offering classes, educational. So when I wrote this up to the IRS, I have to describe their history. I said they started out, and I use the Irish language, they started out as a self-declared 501c7 social club. They met all this criteria, da-da-da-da. And then in this such-and-such year, they began an educational purpose, da-da-da-da-da. The IRS granted them 501c3 status. So now they could take donations, now they can participate in fundraisers, only open to c3, stuff like that.
Speaking of donations, now they've gone from a social club to an educational organization.
Yes.
What if they keep the membership fees the same or raise them? Can people claim those as tax-deductible donations?
No, because the membership fee is what is payment for services. If someone wants to give above and beyond their membership fee, then that's a donation. It's very much like paying tuition at your private schools, your Christian schools or private schools, right? You got to pay tuition first. If you want to do a donation above and beyond that, that's the true donation. So no membership fees are not tax deductible.
Thank you for joining the Dollars and Cents Radio Show with Carol Topp here at the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. For more helpful information, visit Carol at her website, homeschoolcpa.com.